talked about the language, I mean, the possibility of interpretation from the original text, which has been copied and copied and transmitted throughout ages. Then we think about the one absolute criterion of authority and the truthfulness. We think about that in terms of the unchangeable words which are fastened on in heavens, and that is the thing. We have to go beyond the text. Sometimes we have to go deep into the text and behind the text and above the text to see what God really wills. The same thing when you see or hear someone making statements about his interpretation of the words of God, you have to get to know that the statements and opinions and let's say the traditional sayings are not necessarily the words of God or the true intended meaning of the words of God. So you have to see that. So therefore, reflections, observations, opinions, or statements are not equal to the truth stated in the Bible, because these statements or reflections actually are from men, people who might have a bias or might have a lack of training, and therefore his statements may be just partially true or truthful. So therefore, we have to be aware that truth is not equal to your own opinion. Your opinion is not equal to what the biblical truth is about. Remember that. But a devout and godly person would make remarks approximately closer to the intention of God. That is the only thing we can say. But if he really is godly and well-trained, and he is the one who gets to the text faithfully and expounds appropriately, then I think his observations could be, say, okay. Otherwise, if anyone just randomly, freely, and liberally, and tries to state the biblical truth, then we have to put somehow kind of inquisitiveness upon his way of interpretation. Okay, so we have to try to know what and why he says that, whether it's true or not. So this is the way our thinking or approaching people's interpretation of the words of God. Okay, now we are going to talk about the languages. How many languages? What the languages originally written? For example, this is the Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. And these two lines, writing, you write from right to left. In all the world languages used in the world, Hebrew, Arabic, Persian, Tibetan, Mongolian, these are all the letters or alphabets written from right to left. But Chinese and some other languages change the order from right to left to right, because you have to insert the numerals, dates, and so on and so forth. So nowadays we read Chinese from left to right. Otherwise, we have to read from right to left, down from up to the bottom. But anyway, the Hebrew Bible is expressed in this so-called the 20 alphabets. Okay, and then this is a B, that's the R, so that's just a Beth and a Rosh, and that's the S. And then you have to see, if I dot here, put a dot, then this is a Shi Sang. If I put dot over here, it is a Si Sang. So the Bereshit is a T Sang. Bara'a, so you don't need to say, if you write it in a transliteration, then you have to put a comma like that. Now, if I write this Y, like Y, actually, you have to put a reverted comma. So if I change this, then I have to write this way. Okay, then this indicate this. But now I'm writing comma, so this is the Aleph, the first letter in alphabet of Hebrew letters. So bara, Ra'ah, at Elohim. And this indicates all sun. So I write Elohim. Him, because E, this is E sound. And then you treat this as one E sound. So Elohim, the in the N, in we call N consonantal writing, otherwise you write this way. M, in the medial and beginning. Initial or medial, you write M this way. To N, then you write like a half circle, half square. Okay. So Elohim, so in beginning, in the beginning, you don't need to put the H here. In beginning, created God, H is a directive, is pointing to this object, as the object of this verb, create. So in Rashid, Rashid, Bara, Elohim, et ha, this long ah sound. Ah, if I put this, then it's just ah. But maybe you can put this. Okay, it's a long ah sound. So ha she ma, ha she ma ah e. So ha sha mai, ha she mai, ha she mai. This is end. It means ha means the heaven, and et also pointing. This is an object of this bara, and the same one. Okay, the same. Not you don't need to translate. Point to this is the object of this verb, and the aha means the eretz. So you can write this way: either medial or beginning. But it's ending, so you write this way. Zi, zi sawa zi. So, ber, reshit, bara, Elohim, et hashemaye, va et haeret. In the beginning created God the heavens, plural, and the earth. See, so this is Hebrew words. Nothing new, see? And nothing new. Okay. And so this is a bet, the second letter. There's a Rosh, R. Letter she or C, according to that. In a judges, you have the criteria to judge whether you come from this area or not. You remember that? Sifan, Sifan, and Shifani. Oh, you are not our local. In judges, you see, you know the story? Uh-huh. When there's the battle because of the concubine being the... Okay, anyway, you realize yourself. So your pronunciation will determine where you come from. Like your horse, shin or shim. If you skip, you are like a Fukanese. N and L, they don't differentiate. And the person, nonfu, they say longfu. Okay, long and long, they don't. Then we know where you come from. Just like a Japanese R, they used to say lice, mean the nasi. I mean that means the rice. And that determines how you spell it. Okay, so this is the idea about the Hebrew rewriting. Okay, in the Masoretic Bible, we call the Masoretic MT. The Hebrew Bible. So your lecture notes will provide that information for you. Now, we come to the New Testament. The language, actually, the New Testament is written in the Greek. And then in the Greek, we have to read from left to right. And easy to read, because it looks like in English. But beware, when you see P, it's not P, it's R. Okay, unless you write this way, the capitals, then pi, then others, when you write in the cursive, then you have to write this way. Okay, A, with this direction, then voiced. With this direction, okay, so this, they say, O, whole. It's just H, you plus an H there. Okay, that is the only difference. So N, Ahe, N, Ho, Logos, Kai, Ho, Logos, N, Pros, Ton, Teon, Kai, Teos, N, Ho, Logos. So in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God. Okay, you don't say that. With God. And God was the Logos, the Word. Very simple, right? So, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God. And God was the Word. And of course, you have to change the German or French. You have to change the case. Okay, this is a nominative case. And then you have the second case, what? They say accusative, genitive, and then the dative. And then in Latin, you have vocative, that kind of cases. So if you have one bunch of words, okay, Latin words, and then you don't worry, just pick up randomly, just arrange them according to whatever it is, and then you can read them. But some language cannot do that. For example, I say, I hit you, and you can say, you hit me. If you reverse the subject object. And the Chinese don't have that kind of change of cases. And that would make the differences of meaning. Okay, so this is in Greek Testament. We call the New Testament language. But you're going to read. This Greek language also has been used to translate the Hebrew into the Greek Hebrew. We call the Septuagint, LXX means 50, 20, 10 and 10 means 70 in the numeral presentation of the meaning of this Septuagint, the 70. So that is only the introduction of two lines also of the text from the Genesis in Hebrew and John chapter 1 verse 1 in Greek. So that revealed that the language is actually look like this, and what we read is English is a later rendition of the translation versions, and Chinese too. Chinese actually was done by actually Matteo Ricci. When he came to China in the Yuan Dynasty and the Ming Dynasty, that area, that he tried very hard to learn Chinese culture, but at the same time he tried to render the Italian book and Bible or Latin Bible into Chinese. But the work actually was carried out in 19th century when the Jesuits came to China, and they did a great deal of labor in translating into our own. And then later on, we have Chinese people translated and incorporated into our Union version. So I think it's a good topic for us to look into the history of the Bible translation. Okay, in this session, in the name of Jesus, we'd like to just go over quickly. The first session, in the previous session, I talked about the differentiation between text and meaning, text or interpretation. And I also pointed out the divergence in the copies or transmitted texts because of the gap of time and space and the differences of culture and languages. Now in this session, I'd like to go over quickly about the necessary knowledge for us to know about the text itself. So let's turn to the text. Okay, what's the Bible? You have one word, the Biblia. Okay, in line one. That means Biblos. Biblos means the inner bark of the papyrus. Do you know what papyrus is? It's kind of a plant, the reed, R-E-E-D, ruwe. And people can find them, the reeds from River Nile. And from Rio Nile, they can cut these reeds and bake them or bake them in the sun and then dry them up and then flatten them and then and just scrub the inside and then suppress them into the layer of paper. And this kind of material deriving from reeds we call papyrus, papyri, okay? And this is the paper. There was paper used by the ancients. And of course, this is a common stationery. And they could choose skin of lambs or skin goats to use as a material. So sometimes we call it venom, V-E-L-L-O-M. And this kind of material, of course, very precious and dear, expensive. So mostly people would use the papyrus. And therefore, from the writing on the biblios, the papyrus, then we call them biblia. Okay, this idea. And then we have another line, such as the idea of divine library, biblioteca divina, in the middle section. That's a Latin word for a divine Bible library. Well, the Bible itself contains a library of God's dealing with the world and His will and His demands and His works. So it's a library itself. Okay? And this library is not a university or secular library. Rather, it's a divine library. So the entire session is about Biblia or Bibliotheca Divina. These all refer to Bible. And actually, you read the last line. The earliest occurrence in English as the books you can find in a Piers Plowman in the medieval English text, and Chaucer, a 14th century English writer who wrote Canterbury's Tales, very interesting book. English major would have known this. And then Wycliffe, or one of the Christian writers, also translated the Bible, also wrote about the devotional essays and writings. Okay, so this is the idea. Then we come to the second section about people sometimes call what the holy writings or sacred writings, as we have seen in the Bible already, the scripture itself, 圣经, but actually sacred writings or holy writings and so on and so forth. And then come the third section. That's what we have been talking about. Torah, prophets, and hagiographa, in holy writings. And hagiographa, actually, in the Hebrew, means ketubim. Do you know what the Indonesian name for the Bible? We have one. All right, what does the kitab mean? What does the kitab mean? Huh? Words or writing, yes. So, holy, Allah, maybe to do with Allah. With holy or godly writing. Okay, so this is a kitab, actually ketubim, hagiographa. Okay, so you have the Torah, five books of Moses, and you have the Nabim. What does the Indonesian word for prophets? Right. What does the Persian or Arabic mean for prophets? Huh? That's a Persian. How does the Arabic mean for a word for prophets? Do you have sang al Nabi in it? Yeah, the Hebrew and the Arabs are the half brothers. So some words are adopted by Arabs, and later on introduced to. Hollanders introduced it to Indonesia, and they preserved the original word, Nabi. So Nabi contains three prophets, because Daniel was not considered one of the four major Nabis yet. Only in the Christian, he elevated it to the rank of the major prophets. Otherwise, if we talk about the Hebrew Bible, we mention the three major prophets only. And each of the prophets would have one scroll. So you have three scrolls of the major prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. And then you have one scroll which contains 12 minor prophets. So 12 altogether are written into one scroll. So you have four scrolls of Nabi, and then several scrolls of the so-called holy writings, Ketubim, Kitab. Okay, and then of course this will include the rest of the remainder of the books, which are outside the five books of Moses and the major and minor prophets. We all list them all together in the category of the holy writings, hagiographa or ketubim in the Hebrew. Okay, so with this understanding, then the Jewish technical division of the three parts actually already took shape in the year around 150s BC. One of the direct evidences given by Jesus ben Sirach. No, Jesus doesn't mean Jesus Christ. Jesus ben means son of Sirach. He wrote a book called The Wisdom of the Ben Sirach. And that book is very important. If you have a complete Bible with the Apocrypha, that book is listed in the Apocrypha, A-P-O-C-R-Y-P-H-A, Apocryphal Writings, okay? And now this book, Sirach, states that they have the tripartite division of the Old Testament. So we could see that by the 2nd century before Christ, the three-part tripartite Bible, Torah, Nabim, and the Ketubim or Hagiographa had already taken the final shape. And then you might ask, and then how about the New Testament? Then we have to face a question about the canonization. You want to make it a classics, you want to make it a criterion, standard by books, we call it 经典. And then make it a right norm, right standard, right measurement for people to follow. And this kind of a canonizing process took a long time. In the New Testament, we know that Jesus' statements, teachings, and records about his deeds and the teaching, actually, at the closure of the revelation of the New Testament books, okay, at the giving of the revelation given to John, and on the Mount, on the Isle of Patmos, the New Testament has not come into a final shape yet. Okay, so they require another centuries to complete the process of canonization. And of course, you would ask with what criteria they decide the canonization. Of course, with the purity and the theological soundness, okay. So purity in terms of literal and historical quality. Some of the apocryphal writings, actually the dates or the sequences are not correct. We can point it out later on. And if this is not so correct, then they put aside. And then purity, the language is so elevated, style not even so coarse and so rowdy and so bawdy, then they put aside. So literary quality, historical accuracy, and most of all, the theological soundness. And of course, one has to be very devout and well trained to discern. And this group of people can be ranked in the rank of the church fathers, 教父, early apostles, because you see the Bible closes the year around year 96 A.D. when Revelation was written down, Book of Revelation. And of course, there are lots of books around. And it's up to the church fathers or rabbi or those are well-learned scholars and the scribes to decide. And of course, if they are devout enough, well-trained enough, discerning enough, they could do the job. We don't need to send a member from a true church to do that, because by that time it's not possible for us. Even our member to do the canonization work, he must be also of a person of spirit, must be a person spirit-filled and well-learned and whatsoever as required, okay? But we trust that God's guide, the providential care and guidance, that the canonization was thus formed around 4th century And that time we can see lots of the canonical writings from Jewish faith. And also, aside from what I said, the canon. So far we have 27 New Testament books and 39 Old Testament books that have been canonized as fixed texts, or as the so-called the authentic text for us to follow, Old Testament, New Testament, inclusively. But how about the other books? Then I think you have the reference about the Apocrypha in 3.3. Okay, the Apocrypha mean the books put aside with the canonical writings, and these all are dated and in the Greek. Okay, although you have the Sirach, I mean the wisdom of Sirach, Jesu ben Sirach had Hebrew origin, and this Apocrypha, like the name is given here, the Esther, Susanna, Bear and Dragon, and then you have Baruch, and then you have Prayer of the Manasseh, and the Wisdom of Solomon, the first Maccabee. If you read Daniel, you have to read the first Maccabee to know the historical background. The first Maccabee records very clearly. And this we call the Apocrypha, okay? And of course, some of you have study Bible with this the names of the Apocrypha. Then could you just refer to them yourselves? But we like to see several important symbols. Now, so let's come back to 3.2. Aside from Hebrew writing, usually we list them as MT. And then later on we're going to explain. They are in the excursus number 2. We call that section into attention because that is the transmission of the ancient manuscripts. And then, of course, MT has been explained there. Okay, Masoretic text, MT. That means the Hebrew text from the 6th century. Actually, we have. From the 6th century, the Masora, the traditionalists, the scholars in Hebrew faith, they scrupulously did the work. They tried to make a standard text to give the text, but also to give the commentary to the people who like to know the Old Testament. Therefore, in the Old Testament section, under the heading of the ancient manuscripts, I don't know your page, but turn to that. The first item on the Old Testament, you see that the Masoretic text, usually given the signum, S-I-G-L-U-M, that means symbol, signum as M-T. Okay, so you read that passage, you know that Hebrew Bible intended for extensive notes and commentary aside from the text. But most importantly, you could see actually, original writing of Hebrew or even Greek, they don't have the so-called the vocal marks at all. They don't have this kind of a long R, or the middle R, short R. Okay, they don't have, and then this, they don't have the, this sound U. They don't have this sound A. And this is a E. They don't have this E sound. When I put this, it's a phonetic symbol. Okay, I think some of you learned the Greek and the linguistic. If I put this, then there's a phonemic symbol. There's a phonetic symbol. Okay, put under within this the two lines slash, and then you have like we call Shema, but it's okay, Shiva. It's okay. We don't want to say the original name, official name for these two dots. We just say Okay, A E. This has been put into the text. Otherwise, original text doesn't have any symbol at all. It's a real one as a cluster of words. Only the scholars and scribes, well-learned persons, can read without this marking. Okay, there's a read. So some of texts, you can see original texts, they don't have the vocalization. We call it vocalized consonantal mark. Otherwise, if I put this, can you read? Can you pronounce it? Not at all. No way. No, because you don't have vowel to carry them out. You must have the B market, you know, to make it audible and sound and meaningful. Okay. Otherwise, if you put all the consonantal clusters together, no way can you pronounce them. You need to have R-E-U-A-O to make them audible. See? Combine vowels and consonants to make an audible sound meaningful. Okay, so the muscle rates, these muscle rates contribute to the reading of the Hebrew, unmarked Hebrew into vocalization. We call the vowel marking. Okay, today you could just read the unmarked text, but well-learned person can read. We cannot, because we are not the traditionists. We are not the undergone, we haven't undergone such kind of training, you know, so that we know, oh, this is from Genesis chapter 1 verse 1, and then read very smoothly. Likewise, in the New Testament too, okay, but that's another story. So the Old Testament text, we take the idea of MT, Masoretic text, Hebrew Bible. And of course, it's undergone a long process of finalizing up to the 1977. We call BHS, Biblia Hebraica Stuttgantia. Stuttgart, Germany, produces a standard text with the vocalization in 1977, based upon what the original text, BH. Of course, my lecture also indicate that. So whenever you see MT or BHS, Biblia, Bible, Hebraica, Hebrew Bible, published in Stuttgantia, here Stuttgart. Do you know Stuttgart? Where you could see the German bands, okay? Stuttgart, between München and Heidelberg, on Highway 6, German Highway 6. Okay, so this is the area. They produce this Hebrew Bible. Actually, originated by the Rudolf Kittel, and then they revise it and make it a better copy, BHS, instead of BH only. Okay, so this is the story about the Hebrew Bible. Then we come to 3.3. We just finished. We come to the Septuagint. Anyone turn to, I have different pages, so you just say the page. The Septuagint, in the diaspora, do you know diaspora, anyone? Dispersion, anyone? In the area where the Jewish people get settled, we've got diaspora. This is a Greek word, diaspora. Diaspora, when in English it's just a dispersion. Assyrian conquest of Israel in 722, and the Babylonian conquest of Judah in 587 BC, make a people of Jews, I mean actually should say Israelites, and Judahites or Israelites, dispersed outside their own land. Wherever they went, they became settled. So like a Chinese went to Indonesia, another Hakka speaking people. They went down to Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia. And this is the Chinese diaspora in Southeast Asia. Okay. Likewise, in Mediterranean world. Do you know where the Mediterranean Sea is? Do you know? If you are not aware of this, then ask your mother to spank you a little bit. This is common sense. You say, teacher, where is the Di Zhonghai? And then I assume, because of this kind of common sense should be, common knowledge should have been acquired already. But anyway, in the Mediterranean Sea, they have the settlements. and then most of them speak what language they spoke. What language they speak in that area, in those areas? Anyone? Aramaic. A-R-A-M-A-I-C. Aram. Aramean. Aramean. Actually, Syrian. Okay. Jesus Christ and the apostles and the and most people from the land of Palestine speak Aramaic. Okay, there's a common language written in the Hebrew scripts with the dialectal variations, different accents. Like disciples speak Western Galilean accent, and the Judahites, when they debate against the Sennacherib, the army as a chief of Syria. Assyria in 701 at the city wall of Judah. And the Assyrians purposely speak the Judahite dialect. And so people know that they are cursing God and the people of Judah. So although they also branches of Aramaic, and yet are different. Okay, so this is some kind of linguistic knowledge. We have always just acquired them. Now, The language speak by the people at this diaspora is Aramaic. Therefore, for their sake, there must be a common book for them, because they aside from the dialect, but they, generally speaking, they have to use official language. Since 332, Alexander the Great came to power, and then he conquered part of Africa, part of Europe, and part of Asia. So he unified the entire empire, and he promoted this Hellenistic culture, Sinahua Wenhua. Therefore, language, Greek language, was a very common language. So for the sake of the commonality of the use of the Bible, Hebrew Bible, so the rabbi, or the we call scribes or teachers, have to translate Hebrew into Greek. Thus, we call this version as the Septuagint. The origin of the Septuagint, the 70, actually from 6 members from each of the 12 tribes to make that committee, and then they translate the Hebrew Bible into Greek, and they rotate reading and correcting, and finally they take shape during the reign of the Ptolemy of the Egypt. And that is about the 2nd century B.C. So most diaspora people, Jews, would be familiar about the Septuagint, the 70. And this is a Greek translation of Hebrew done by the 70 members, highly well-trained scholars in Egypt, Alexandria. Okay, Alexandria, Egypt. So this is a Greek Hebrew. So this is the Old Testament. And the New Testament, let's come to the section about New Testament. Of course, I think you have some misprints because of the software that does not have that kind of foreign letters. Now we have the NT, okay? Now I come to your excursus. Okay, come to four. New Testament. Well, in 4.1, you have Greek versions. The most important is LXX, the Septuagint. That is the Greek version of Old Testament. And 4.2, Targums. Actually, this is Aramaic Bible. Targumim. This is Targum or Targums in English. Simply mean the Aramaic Bible. For those who speak Aramaic, common people who speak Aramaic. So Targum, T-A-R-G-U-M. Actually, it has two versions. One is for the Jews in Babylon. The other for the Jews in Palestina. So you have Babylonian and the BT, and Jerusalem or Palestinian Targum. Okay? So this is the Aramaic Bible. Then 4.3, Peshitta. Peshitta is some with writing a P. It's small, so I mean the italic P. Then we know this refers to the Syriac. S-Y-R-I-A-C, Syriac. So the people, Jewish people and the believers in Syria use the text Peshitta because this is the authorized Bible of the Syrian church around 4th and 5th century AD. Now Peshitta, whenever you think about Peshitta, then you sometimes you read this as the Syriac, and then you have the Siglam read that way. Read this as Syriac. And Targum, you write this way. And the Masoretic, you write MT. And then for the Septuagint, you write LXX. This we call a Sigla, or Siglum, S-I-G-L-U-M. The symbol is a Siglum, Siglum, Siglum. Okay. Then we have the Coptic. Coptic is also written in Greek letters, because this actually is this language used in Egypt. So the Egyptian text in the Greek we call Coptic. Of course, you have the dialectal variation Sahidi and the Boharic, such as kind of variation. So Coptic, remember, is written in Greek, used by the Egyptian Greek speaking members. Then we have Latin. Latin, actually, you have history here from Old Latin and down to Jerome, 346 to 420 in 4th and 5th century. He translated into the Vulgate. So in the Siglum of VG, we know this means Latin. Vulgate means a common Latin. So that means from the Old Latin, Jerome also rendered into a copy which has become a standard text, Latin text, Vulgate. So simply use the signum of VG to represent the Latin version. So this, the idea about the text, and then we come to the final section about Old Testament. And this section should pertains to Old Testament, about Hebrew Bible. And then you have the Ginsberg, and you have the British Sovereign Bible Society in 1926, and then you have Rudolf Keitel in the Biblia Hebraica. And then we come to the New Testament. Quickly, we're running out of time now. In the New Testament section, actually we find that more complicated. For example, in the third paragraph, you have a codex. Well, similar in Chinese, we call Chaoben, Shou Chaoben. Codex Alexandrinus. This was discovered in 1859 by the Tischendorf at a monastery on the Mount Sinai. And then Codex Sinaiticus is a complete New Testament dating in the 4th century. The earliest copy of the Codex so far we found or discovered is the Aleph. Codex Alexandrinus or Alexandrinus. This is representing the 4th century copy, or we say Codex, Shou Chaoben. In that sense, that we have not had any original copies at all. For the New Testament, we don't have the first copy of any scripture. What we have is copies after copies. And the finding, actually, was unearthed gradually in the 18th century, 19th century, or sometimes we also find out earlier people in the 13th or 14th century have found this copy, but that copy found pertains to the copies, copy to copy. That means this is not the authentic, original, first copy. So remember, but after the discovery of the Qumran text, we marvel at the authenticity of the copy, accuracy of the copy, without losing the original words in the Dead Sea Scrolls, okay, especially Isaiah scrolls in the Qumran text. We're going to study that later on. So this is the one we know that Aleph. Therefore, in your text, you might have the strange graphic symbol. You see that? You have something different from original. You must have some kind of box or some kind of round and then a curved shape. You have that kind of design in your lecture notes because of the printout machine efficiency in the ability to produce the Hebrew Aleph. Okay, so in that section, I hope your counselor can provide you with that right Aleph, this word, representing the Alexandrian, the Codex Alexandrinus. So this is the one. And then we'd like to come to P, papyrus. Okay, written in the papyri, papyrus. Then you have a P46, named after Chester Beatty. Okay, so P45, P46, Chester Beatty. Okay, and then you read yourself. And then you have P52, P56, P75. They were stored in different places, some in Leningrad, Geneva, Paris, British Museum, or University of Washington, or University of whatnot, that Baltimore. Those are locations contain or store the original copy of their finding, like P46, P52. And from the study of the P46, for example, let's see, the first chapter, first verse, the first few verses of Ephesus. Paul's writing is directed to the members in Ephesus, but P46 did not have that in Ephesus. Okay, so that idea is there. So some copies or some codex or papyrus have this word in Ephesus, but P46 that didn't have. But that's okay. That's a textual problem, a textual criticism. So with the P or with the original codex, we can know, can compare the texts. Okay, and then come to the point to the uncials. Like R should be in there. See, Codex Sinaiticus, this should be there. Okay? I think you have different symbol. Should be this way. Okay. That is the signum for this Codex Sinaitica. Then we have another one, I think. So please read this item yourself. You have, let's say, you have, you see, if you see the, in one place you have a lambda, in other place you have phi, but your printout have different shapes, graphic icon shapes or design. You have to change yourself. Okay, so this is the idea about the text of the Old Testament, New Testament, and we like to cover the rest. I hope this kind of material will not be so dull, so dry, so mechanical, and so far-fetched. But as members of the Trudia Church, or as a member of the Youth Theological Seminar, these are the basic items of biblical knowledge. It suffices for us to really know something, and it doesn't harm at all. It's quite conducive to us, because the more we know, the more we are better off. So may the Lord bless us. Okay, tomorrow we enter the Bible text itself, after having introduced the mechanics or fundamentals of what the Bible is, or how the Bible has come to us in different versions. And I hope you read, okay? You read the lecture notes. And let's pray in silence to conclude.